He was playing in a small club in Mississippi, and to warm that club, they had a kerosene fire and kind of a round kind of cylinder thing to warm up the club. A fight ensued between two people in the club. It got kerosene fire that was keeping the place warm tipped over. It ignited the flames all throughout the club. Everybody scurried out, including BB. He realized when he got out that he left his guitar in there. He went back in to get the guitar, which was kind of a foolish thing to do, which he admitted many times. And he got the guitar and left. After it was over, he understood that the two guys were fighting over a woman by the name of Lucille. And from that day forward, that was the story of the naming of Lucille. The guitar he was using at that time was not a Gibson Lucille guitar, obviously, but from that day forward, he named that guitar Lucille.
All great stories are love stories, and the life of B.B. King was no exception. You can literally see or hear B.B. King in the background of almost every major event in American history during the 20th century. He grew up when slavery was still acceptable, even if it wasn't legally called that. He watched the civil rights era explode. He played alongside hippies during the Summer of Love. He collaborated with rock stars on stages around the world. And for each one of these events, next to every hotel, motel bed, sofa, floor, and chair, he always had his lucky lady Lucille by his side. It never bothered his daughter Shirley. As a musician herself, she respected the love affair.
So nobody has had the pleasure, not a wife, not a parent, not nobody has had the pleasure of living with B.B. King except Lucille. That was the thing that carried him from the fields to fame and made him, you know, become who he became. Lucille was his only personal thing that stuck with him no matter what. He didn't divorce her. He didn't ever leave her nowhere. So she was the only person that could say, if she could talk, then we would really know B.B. King's real story.
You know it's B.B. from one note. There is no one else in the world who can make Lucille sing the way B.B. can. It's not something that can be taught. It comes directly from his heart. B.B.'s close friend Chris Closure knows this firsthand.
Right now, if you hear any blues lick, if I may, you know whether or not B.B. was playing it because of the particular sound that he got out of Lucille. And it was very distinctive to B.B., and he's one of those few musicians out there that, you know, if you hear four or five notes sometime, somewhere, someplace, you know if whether or not it was B.B. playing Lucille. And that was a love affection that very few artists have with their music, if not their instruments. And it was very unique to B.B. King and still is to this day.
Welcome to A Life Lived. I'm Stephanie Okupniak. Let's go back to a little town in Mississippi called Itabena. Have a seat on a hard, wiry chair made from twisted vines on a humid summer evening. The sun has started to set, and the gnats and the mosquitoes are buzzing across your face. You've worked a long, hard day in the fields. You've sweat so much, your clothes are sticking to your back. That hard chair is heaven to your lower back and your feet. Close your eyes for a moment while you listen to your kids playing barefoot in the dirt road ahead of you, and take a sip of White Lightning. Suddenly, you hear a twang, and the breeze carries the sound of field holler as your neighbors walk home. You have no idea you're listening to the birth of the blues. B.B. King was born Riley B. King in the cotton fields between Itabena and Indianola on September 16, 1925. The house he lived in with his parents was crooked and falling apart. It provided little shelter from the elements. Drummer Tony Coleman told me this was the reason why BB always kept the tour bus at baking temperatures, and he refused to sleep with the lights out.
He grew up in a barn. He slept on the plantation that he worked on. So I'm sure there was moments when it was extremely cold growing up in that barn. So he never liked being cold. I think it reminded him of that.
BB's parents separated while he was still very young and his mother moved away. Until BB was old enough to work in the cotton fields, he bounced from relative to relative. His great-aunt Jemima had a mustache and a phonograph. She also favored snuff and kissing her grandnephew. BB hated getting kissed with the snuff-filled mustache, but he loved listening to her phonograph. And when he knew he was going to visit, he reminded himself, I only have to kiss her once. But he would get to listen to records all day long. It was worth the sacrifice. Eventually, he moved in with his grandma, and his father moved away. His education was limited. He was mostly homeschooled until he was 8 years old. Then he began walking 5 miles to the Elkhorn Schoolhouse, where he was taught in a room with children from first through eighth grade.
He had a difficult childhood, but he never complained about it. You know, he picked cotton. He was kind of shuffled around a bit between mother, father, grandmother, being on his own at some point, riding a bicycle 80 miles away from one family he wasn't comfortable with to go back to another. We did talk about that, but it was never kind of like, woe is me, or it was a bad experience. It was an experience.
BB had a preacher in the family who played guitar. After giving his sermons, they would all gather round and he would play for the family. This is how BB's love for the guitar was ignited. In the church, BB was given the opportunity to learn to play the guitar. That was what brought him real happiness. When BB was 14, his mom, Nora Ella, died from diabetes, and shortly after, his grandma died as well. He was left alone. BB would grow up working in those cotton fields until he was 18 years old. He plowed with a mule pushing around 30 miles a day, 6 days a week. He paid off his grandma's debt of $40. Difficult when you only earn $15 a month.
Can you imagine living on your own in a house by yourself, picking up the responsibility of your parents' bills and things that they left undone, and you having to fix it and carry on still alone? You know, my father's life was the blues.
Oppression was very present. The KKK lived in the area. The White Citizen Council formed close to BB's home. Segregation wasn't a topic of discussion. It was the devil on your doorstep. BB saw lynchings. You never forget that. Black people were seen as objects, not people with rights.
BB grew up in the South, in Mississippi, during American apartheid when, you know, segregation and the civil rights movement. BB grew up seeing black people get castrated and murdered and killed and hung and all of that stuff and getting beat up. If you look at a white man, you know, he'd smack you upside the head, you know. That's hard to have to grow up like that. It's hard for a black man to be successful going through that, you know, in America. It was difficult.
He left his father's house in Lexington on a bicycle and rode 50 miles back to Indianola. He pulled up to a cotton plantation, and the cartilage family who owned it took him in. They gave him a job and a home. One afternoon, Mr. Cartilage was offered a guitar by a traveling salesman, and he knew BB wanted one. So he bought it for him, and BB paid him back. BB's music scared some people, especially the church parishioners. They thought it was the devil's music. He joined the St. John Gospel Singers, singing and playing guitar. He decided to get married, and he and his new wife moved into a 3-room shotgun house with her family. BB worked Monday through Saturday, and as soon as he finished Saturday evening, he would head into town to play with his band. BB started by playing on street corners and eventually made his way into juke joints.
Those are some of the greatest times he had. He never complained about playing on a street corner with his guitar case open with people flipping coins in it. That was just part of the experience along the way, and that kind of led to his spirituality, if I may. He never bore any bitterness or sadness or tragedy, but he was proud of his race and proud of his religion and proud of the things he was doing.
BB started traveling as far as Memphis. He said the music was calling him. He met fellow musicians and realized he knew nothing about the business. He was inspired and he wanted to learn more, so he found his cousin Booker White, and Booker took BB under his wing. He taught him about showmanship, how to dress, and about different guitars and how to play them, skills he used throughout his career. He started to play at amateur nights for the experience and the meager dollar it paid. After a few months, he went back to the plantation, but by the time he returned to Memphis, he was ready to springboard his career. BB went to visit Sonny Boyd at a radio station. He auditioned for him and was offered a job on the radio as a DJ.
WDIA presents the award-winning feature, Brown America Speaks.
WDIA was the first all-black operated station in the South, and every day for 5 years, you could hear BB King playing the blues. That's where he got the name BB. His DJ nickname was Blues Boy, and it just stuck. After a while, BB's creative instincts kicked in, and he started to look to make a record. He even wrote jingles while he tried to find somewhere to get his music in the can. He first recorded for Bullet Records in Nashville, Tennessee. His first single was a song for his wife, titled Martha King. His music began playing in jukeboxes as far as Los Angeles.
He always wanted to represent the blues with class and dignity and respect. Because so many people assume if you're from the blues, like he would say, if some guy with his teeth out, eyes bloodshot, red, can't hardly speak, got a jug of whiskey up pointed to the west and his cap pointed to the east, BB was like, we got to present the blues with class and dignity, like jazz, like the black jazz artists, you know. Because BB really wanted to be a jazz musician. More jazz blues. And a lot of people don't want to embrace that it's a black origin from America based on black folks. A lot of people would like to think it's just an art form, but they don't know it's a culture involved in blues. That's why blues is different from all the other kind of music, because it came from a lot of blood, a lot of hurt, a lot of pain, and a lot of joy and happiness. But it came from black people who had to keep their mouths shut and get their ass beat and still smile.
The single was a hit, and BB was asked to record another. He realized he must be doing pretty well, so he asked his recording company for a new guitar. When they offered him two new guitars, he promised them two hit records. He named one of those guitars Lucille.
Every guitar that BB played was named Lucille. Later in his career, you know, Gibson made the special BB King guitar, and Lucille made a particular sound that only BB King could make out of a guitar.
BB started to tour with black artists in black theaters. Being on the road puts a strain on a marriage, especially with no technology to help bridge the gap. Martha left BB, and BB's new relationship was the tour. They were together the rest of his life. Tony Coleman remembered what it was like performing and touring with the Driven Professional.
Working with BB was very frustrating for me because he was extremely disciplined about not allowing anything, not letting anything affect you when you're on stage. All that you're going to do is come on stage and play for the people for however long you're supposed to be there. I don't want you thinking about anything else. I don't care if you got a heartache, a headache, a backache, a toe ache, a stomach ache, a toothache. It does not matter. You don't have any of that until after the show. I want you to focus and be able to stop on a dime. If I, you know, you got to watch him and listen to him. BB did not have a set list. He just played whatever he felt, however the audience was.
Every album BB released while touring with the Black artists were hit after hit. BB learned how to be a band leader from watching and listening to them. Eventually, BB decided to take his band and go solo. He bought a bus, and it was like buying his freedom.
I played in every town in America, every city in America, every country, 98 countries around the world with BB King. 320 days a year, we were touring. If you're having fun on your run, as we say, then it's not so bad because there's the work part, traveling, but most people are at home in their bed asleep. We're rolling down the highway in tour buses headed to another city, you know? Or we fly across the world. We might travel, but one gig might require us to travel for 20 hours.
Segregation was still rife in the South. They couldn't eat in the same restaurants as white people. They couldn't stay in the same hotels. BB was staying a few doors down from Martin Luther King Jr. in Birmingham, Alabama, at the height of the civil rights movement. Martin's life was constantly being threatened. Someone tried to assassinate him by planting a bomb in his room, but they got the room number wrong and planted the bomb in the room in between him and BB. They both narrowly missed the heinous assassination attempt. BB didn't care how rough the area was or the conditions it was under. For BB, you got paid when you worked, and he worked 365 days a year. It was tough. He met Sue while he was on the road, and they got married in Detroit by Reverend Franklin, Aretha Franklin's father. Sue joined him on the road, and they traveled all over America. Wherever he could, he would go fishing. He didn't care the conditions. He would fish in a silk suit if that was the only clothes he had. He also enjoyed playing baseball, and he even learned how to fly.
He had his pilot's license. He did fly himself. It would have taken wild horses to drag me in a plane to let BB fly me around. When I got in the band, his manager had insisted that he stop flying himself because he didn't want to have any problems.
When BB performs, he takes you on a journey. It's not about technique. It's about evoking an emotion in his audience. It's being in the moment and telling a story. He would close his eyes, and you wouldn't be able to discern where his fingertips stopped and the guitar strings began.
He never sang and played the guitar at the same time. The singing was between when he played the guitar, or the guitar playing was in between the singing.
Live at the Regal and Live in Cook County Jail became the masterclass albums for blues musicians and music aficionados even today. BB would never have called himself the King of the Blues because he was a constant student. T-Bone, Sam Cooke, Bobby Blue Bland, and so many more musicians inspired him and taught him along his career. BB was a magpie, and he happily admitted that. BB's daughter Shirley loved watching the shows backstage and couldn't understand why everyone was making such a fuss over her father.
You know, all these R&B famous singers, and BB King would be one of the acts. And I'm thinking, wow, I was honored to see Jane Brown and blah, 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 not knowing that my father was one of the greatest of them. But I was a kid. You know, I was happy to see, you know, the Jane Brown and Jackie Wilson and Sam Cooke. So it took me a minute to realize how famous my father was. It really did. And I really always thought about how everybody's walking up to me wishing they could be me, and I'm sitting there being happy to see Jane Brown and everybody. So as a kid, I really didn't know how famous my dad was. I really didn't.
Sid Seidenberg took over BB's management and wanted to take him out of the Chitlin circuit and make him a headline act. He had the talent, the band, the bus. He just needed the marketing. In the 60s, the English rockers were heavily influenced by the American blues sound, especially the unique twang of the blues guitar. As the British invasion came to America, it spread the love for the blues to places and generations that never listened to it before. BB was starting to be invited to rock venues, playing to mainly white crowds. It turned the tides for BB. The money was better, his popularity was soaring, and women were fighting for BB's attention.
I mean, BB, I tell you, he never saw an ugly woman in his life. He said that. He loved women. I mean, you never saw any photos of BB other than his wife that he married after his first wife, his second wife, when he was married. You see photos of the two of them together and stuff. But after that, you never saw any photos of BB with one particular lady in his life ever. You never saw him attending any award shows, anything with a lady on his arm. BB was a ladies' man. BB was a player, as we could say. BB loved women. I mean, you don't have 15, 13 different people in your life, kids in your life that you call your kids, unless you love ladies.
BB and his band opened for the Rolling Stones on their 1969 tour. It was an education for both of them. It was very surreal because even though both bands could work together, they couldn't hang out in the same places together. No matter what, BB always showed his appreciation to his fans, no matter how long it took.
BB King would talk to every fan after the show for 3 hours, longer than the show. He let the fan walk on his tour bus, walk through the front door of his tour bus, go to the back where he is, through his bus, sit down, talk to him, do that 300 times. No artist does that. Let you on their tour bus? That's like letting you in their private home.
It was a nice, probably 12 to 15 minute conversation on his bus after his performance, and it was a thrill. It was a thrill to meet one of your heroes. I watched the performance carefully. I was amazed how tight the band was and how he led the band with great precision. I asked him if he always toured with all the horn players, and he said yes. And I remember asking him about, did he always conclude each performance with "The Thrill Is Gone," and all those kind of fan type questions that probably people have asked him a zillion times, but you know, he was more than cordial about answering them and then wanted to know about me. It was a wonderful performance.
"The Thrill Is Gone" was BB's biggest hit. It transcended blues, pop, rock in a way that had never been done before. The addition of strings in the background of that song elevated BB into his own category of music. He won the Grammy Award for Best Male R&B Vocal Performance for the single in 1971. It would be the first of 8 Grammy Awards the King of Blues would win, and countless awards for his music and performances over his lifetime. The same year, BB went on his first overseas tour and recorded BB King in London. He invited George Harrison into the studio, and the chemistry was just kismet. There is so much to celebrate with BB's life, and we'll keep going. But first, let's take a short break to hear from our sponsors. When we come back, we'll find out how thrilled BB King was to serenade a Rumble in the Jungle and how scared he was to duet with the first Black American president. We're sponsored this week by Wild, a natural deodorant company that focuses on performance, sustainability, and style. Now, I've been doing a lot of research about the nasties that you find in regular high street deodorants. But all the natural deodorants that I've tried, well, they're not effective. I mean, pit stains are humiliating. Not to mention the fact that you still get a bit of your own musk, if you will. And nobody likes the yellow marks that are left behind on your shirts. I mean, I don't know about you, but I can never get them out. That's why I've been so thrilled by Wild. It keeps me dry and smelling so fresh all day long. It doesn't contain any aluminum and parabens, and it's also vegan, cruelty-free, and eco-friendly. With Wild, you get this funky reusable applicator that comes in a range of cool colors. I'm currently rocking the purple, my fave. And the deodorant refills are 100% biodegradable, recyclable, and plastic-free. I mean, no guilt, people. You can smell fresh and be free. I love the orange zest scent, and my husband's using the mint fresh fragrance. The great thing is that all five are totally unisex. You can get started with Wild from just 12 pounds and select a subscription plan to suit your lifestyle with refills delivered right to your door. So go wild today and get yourself this natural, refillable deodorant that genuinely works, people. Just head to wearewild.com and you'll get 20% off your first order and free delivery when you use LIVED at checkout. That's wearewild.com and offer LIVED at checkout for 20% off. Wild. Deodorant redefined. The government of Zaire wanted Bibi to perform at the legendary Rumble in the Jungle fight between Muhammad Ali and George Foreman in 1974. He performed to an audience of 50,000 people, celebrating Black sports and Black music. Bibi was very unique with how he managed his band. No matter what the schedule demanded, he always looked after them.
He felt obligated to take care of his people, you know, all of us that worked for him, because BB paid us whether we worked or not. We got half salary when we were off. We had dental and medical insurance, and he would give us bonuses periodically, you know. So he felt obligated to taking care of his people.
He had a white bass player for a while. His name is Michael Doster. And one time, I think I pointed that out to him, and he said, yeah, Michael's just a fabulous bass player and good guy. And then later, down the road, Michael wasn't playing, and I said, what happened to Michael? He says, Michael has gotten very sick. I said, he has? Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. But BB said very proudly to me, but I've kept him on the payroll. And I think that said a lot.
On July 13th, 1985... B.B. King played Live Aid to millions of adoring fans around the world.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much.
B.B. never slowed down. Touring all year was his life, his love, and it gave him opportunity to constantly collaborate. U2 invited him to tour with them in 1989. They recorded the hit single When Love Comes to Town together. Keith Richards introduced U2 to B.B. King, and they idolized his work. U2, Rolling Stones, David Bowie, The Beatles, all of the greats at some point talk about B.B. King, Etta James, and the blues community, and how much they have impacted their music. Blues music is a milestone in music history, and if it didn't exist, modern rock and roll and many other art forms would certainly not exist. Beyoncé wouldn't exist. It just wouldn't be possible. The expression of misery and pain and joy and transformation. There's nothing like it in music history. And yet with all this praise, the acknowledgement, the camaraderie, B.B. King never made as much money as the white artists he inspired.
Black people have created some great music, great art, and don't get half the money that white artists have gotten emulating them. So people don't like you to talk about it because they go, well, you sound bitter. Well, I am angry and bitter about that. That's bullshit. And B.B. King was no different. B.B. King and Buddy Guy's the last one alive now, but B.B. King didn't start making money until he toured with U2. B.B. King should have been making money just like other artists who emulated black people, flying around in private jets and filling arenas well. If they had the same management and the same money invested in them, they could have been just as big or bigger. But too many managers were stealing their money from them. And they were too afraid or just too happy to be on stage to even worry about it. And B.B. King was no different.
B.B. played with Ronnie Wood, Eric Clapton, George Harrison, and Bonnie Raitt. He played around the world at huge events like Glastonbury and stadiums. B.B. played with everyone.
Change is good. And one thing about B.B., he tried everything with different artists. Every kind of artist you can name, B.B. performed with them. We've been on stage with the Red Hot Chili Peppers. We shared rooms with Metallica. B.B. been on stage with Pavarotti.
B.B. was always open to collaborating and experimenting. He felt the best path was to move forward and embrace new experiences and new things. But B.B. never forgot his roots and the pain of his heritage. He led a pilgrimage home every year to honor the civil rights activist Medgar Evers at the Medgar Evers Homecoming Festival.
He recalled those experiences in different ways at different times as it relates to, you know, those influences that helped him appreciate how he ended up. And that appreciation was very deep-seated and kept him humble. You know, he was a very precise guy to work for. And it was, you know, a lot of people like to say it was a school of hard knocks. Well, B.B. never looked at it that way. It was the cards he was dealt. He dealt with them and, you know, grew from those experiences along the way from very humble beginnings to, you know, great stardom. And he never forgot where he came from. It was not a sense of sadness or a sense of deprivation or not being able to ultimately enjoy the good things of life along the way.
George W. Bush awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom to B.B. in 2006. In 2008, Indianola honored the King of Blues by opening a museum. The state of Mississippi honored him by declaring February 15th as B.B. King Day. But B.B. felt truly flattered and nervous playing for President Barack Obama.
This is fabulous. He goes, this is beyond my wildest dreams. I said, okay. He goes, I get pulled off tour from time to time where I have to go do these other things, but look at the things I get to do. I get to go accept Grammy Awards. I get to play for presidents. But he did say, I got pulled off to play for Barack Obama at the White House. And that was, you know, I'd done that before for other presidents. That was fine. But boy, I'm nervous about this one. And I said, why are you nervous about this one, B.B.? I mean, he is president of the United States. I'm sure it would make everybody nervous, but you've done it before. And he goes, no, they said they want me to play Sweet Home Chicago and the president may come down and sing with me. And so he goes, oh boy, that's a tough one, because what if I'm not playing well or I got the key wrong or the president of the United States comes down and doesn't know the words or he doesn't sing real well? Or he goes, I'm really worried about that. What should I do? And I said, have you talked about a rehearsal? He goes, well, he may come by beforehand and we could rehearse a little things and I wouldn't be so nervous, but I'm put in this position where the president of the United States is going to sing a blues song that I don't know really well, but I'm learning, and it's going to be on national TV live. I said, well, you've got to get comfortable. You've got to talk to his people. And I tuned in that night, and it gave you goosebumps. Come on. They never missed a note. The president sang so well, so did B.B., and, you know, it gave him true joy and happiness. And the day after, we were lucky enough to talk, and he was still on cloud nine. And stories like that are priceless. The performance was good or whatever, but here I was in a position to talk to B.B. about it right afterwards. It was pretty special. I did ask BB what was his best performance ever once, and he said it was the 1973 performance at the prison outside New York City, playing for prisoners. That was widely known as what BB said was his best performance. But that whole evening with President Obama was the real time I detected it in his voice, both before and after. He was really, really shook by it. But it turned out really great.
BB was diabetic, and he suffered from several other conditions. The grueling touring schedule was beginning to catch up with him. In 2014, he had a shaky performance at the Peabody Opera House in St. Louis. His fans voiced their concerns on social media. They were worried he might have Alzheimer's disease or dementia.
He set me straight. You know, I was trying to be a little, you know, be his friend and express worry about, you know, his stamina and his health and everything else. And he basically hit it out of the ballpark. He said, "Don't worry about that. I'm fine. I deal with those things, but I love doing this. This is my relaxation. This is my hobby. This is my work, but this is my happiness." And I let it go after that.
Later that year, he fell on stage while performing at the House of Blues in Chicago and canceled several gigs after that.
In my opinion, BB should have been off the road 5 years before he got sick. He shouldn't have been headlining concerts anymore, because he had arthritis in his fingers. He wasn't able to play the way he used to. And he started forgetting lyrics like most people do when they get old. He started forgetting things. And he wasn't going to use a teleprompter to sing on stage. So when he would forget things and he can't play anymore, and he's the king of the blues, I cried about four times on stage watching BB. Just, he shouldn't have been on the road that long. That's all I'm saying. Because he was a good man, and he loved his audiences, but he just couldn't do it anymore. But he wasn't going to just stop until he couldn't do it anymore. That's what he did. But I wish they wouldn't have pushed him so much to continue to play like that. His daughter, Patty King, let me visit him. It was the most saddest thing I ever experienced in my life to watch him dying there, because he was so skinny. He looked like a Holocaust victim. He talked, and his eyes lit up when he saw me, and we talked, and then his daughter called me. He had a little mild stroke, and she called me and said that she had him taken to the hospital.
BB's daughter Shirley said it was really difficult seeing him in such a fragile state.
The first day I saw him, he was like out of it, just that sick. And when I saw him the second time, he was kind of like just in a daze. I knew my father was not going to be here much too longer.
BB King died in his sleep on May 14th, 2015.
He asked me to speak at his funeral, and much to my surprise, and asked me to, he said, "There'll be a few eulogists and there'll be the minister there, but if you would thank a few people for me." And I said, "Okay." He goes, "You probably ought to get a pencil and a paper." And I said, "Okay, I'll do that." So I took down what BB wanted me to say. He wanted me to thank some people. He wanted me to thank his dear personal assistant, Laverne Tony, who I spoke with, and they wanted to make certain that I publicly thanked her, and also Tina France, who ran his affairs out of their New York office. And I said I would. It was a little sad conversation had. He said he wanted me to make sure those people that had some of the biggest influences on his life, what was on his mind that day, were Eric Clapton and Keb Moe and Bonnie Raitt and, as I said, Bobby Blue Bland and Buddy Guy and Steve Cropper and Billy Preston and his dear friend Tommy Peters, who came up with the idea of the BB King Blues Clubs. And, you know, we kind of laughed it off, saying, you know, that'll be a long time in coming and stuff. But sure enough, when I was notified that BB had actually passed away, they said, "Chris, you better get ready to come to Indianola." So I did, and I delivered the message to a crowd of, 400 in the church and thousands on public TV and tens of thousands who have since seen it and listened to it in the radio. And that was hard, but, I did what I was asked to do, and I hope I did it hope I pleased B.B. King that day by what I did. Lucille was next to the casket up on a stand and walked out behind the casket as it was loaded on the hearse. I think it would have pleased B.B., but of all the people who didn't want to be there, B.B. would have been the first, would have been the most wishing he hadn't had to participate in that. But it ended up being a joyous spiritual service in recognition of a wonderful man.
For those of us here in Indianola and around the world, B.B. King is a legend, an icon, a musical giant, a world-class entertainer. But to those of you seated before me, he's family.
B.B. King went home, and it was a wonderful experience to go home with him. And I wish he was here today more than anybody knows.
B.B. had one final request for Shirley before he died.
He started singing the song, "Please See That My Grave Is Kept Clean. Please See That My Grave Is Kept Clean." And to go to his home going and see him put in a muddy grave, because it rained and stormed like crazy when they were getting ready to put B.B. King in that ground. And my daddy was very afraid of the dark. People don't know, my dad never cut off a light in no place he ever stayed. He slept with the light on. The light was something he never wanted out. And so to be put in a muddy ground, I think that really spoke a volume to me, because I'm thinking to myself, you're not keeping my daddy's grave clean, because first of all, you're putting him in a muddy grave. Then the grave looked really tacky for a long time until they could raise some money to put some concrete down.
Thousands of fans honored the King of Blues by lining Beale Street in Memphis, Tennessee to pay tribute at his funeral procession. They marched back to Indianola, Mississippi, and laid the Beale Street Blues Boy to rest.
We got together with the city of Memphis to do a celebration of B.B.'s life, and they brought his body through Beale Street for the last time and drove him to Mississippi, where the Mississippi Highway Patrol took over from the Tennessee Highway Patrol, and they took him to Indianola. And I went out to Vegas to his service out there, and I stayed by the grave when they lowered his casket into the vault, and it was drizzling rain, and everybody had left, and I was standing there, and Reggie Richards, the bass player, and Reggie Taylor, the security and bus driver, came over and grabbed me and said, "Tony, you got to go," because I didn't realize how much I had loved this man and was missing him, and it dawned on me at that moment, I realized it was over,
The blues will be permanently revitalized because of the King of the Blues, B.B. King. And I think, the way storytelling was done by B.B. King was the example for all blues people today and in the future. And it was a form of music that now is acknowledged to be as important as any other form. And that is his legacy. His public legacy, I think his personal legacy, would be how sweet a man he was and how interested he was in other people and how kind and generous. And he was such a wonderful friend to many people on a personal level. It was really nice to have a friend.
Hopefully humanity will wake up to realize we got to take care of each other. And just because we're different and we think different don't mean we can't be friends. But the most important thing that I learned from B.B. King is just respect, man. Respect. You got to respect everybody. Just respect them. Just respect. Even if they treat you like shit, you still got to respect them. See, that's hard to do. I'm going to correct you now. I'm going to correct you about treating me like shit and disrespecting me, but I'm going to respect you while I do it. Does that make sense? That's what I learned from B.B. King.
Shirley King released her new album with Cleopatra Records on Juneteenth this year, called Blues for a King. Tony Coleman is a blues drummer and still records and tours with a variety of artists. Chris Closure is a businessman and was BB's dear friend since 1988. Next on A Life Lived.
One day, on a Sunday, I was listening to my scanner, and I heard Tom's assistant, Alan Bugs Wydell. He went, "Hey, don't tell anybody, but Tom's here with Bob Dylan. And it's freaking us out. It's incredible." And so, yeah, Tom's really excited. He's really excited. And the next day, I think I called Tom and go, "Hey, Tom, how's it going with Bob Dylan?" He says, "How do you know I'm working with Bob Dylan?" Well, and then I went and showed him.
From the swamp waters of Gainesville, Florida, a blonde-haired hippie drove to L.A. with a demo tape and a dream. Record promoter John Scott told us how Tom Petty's determination made him an American treasure. This is an Audio Boom original production by Muddy Knees Media and Breaking Stereotypes. This podcast was presented and executive produced by me, Stephanie Okupniak. Our series editor has been Lucy Oliva. If there is an icon that you would like to know more about, you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram using the handle @alifelived_.